13.
Yous guys think this, deleted, outfit is a blankety-blank nursery? Well, it ain't, see?
Remark attributed to a Hellenic corporal before the walls of Troy. 1194 BC. The Roger Young carries one platoon and is crowded. The Tours carries six and is roomy. She has the tubes to drop them all at once and enough spare room to carry twice that number and make a second drop. This would make her very crowded, with eating in shifts, hammocks in passageways and drop rooms, rationed water, inhale when your mate exhales, and get your elbow out of my eye. I'm glad they didn't double up while I was in her. She has the speed and lift to deliver such crowded troops still in fighting condition to any point in Federation space and much of bug space. Under Cherenkov drive, she cranks Mike 400 or better. Say, Seoul to Capella. 46 light years in under 6 weeks. Of course, a 6th platoon transport is not big compared with a battle wagon or passenger liner. These things are compromises. The MI prefers speedy little 1-platoon corvettes, which give flexibility for any operation. While if it was left up to the Navy, we would have nothing but regimental transports. It takes almost as many Navy files to run a corvette as it does to run a monster big enough for a regiment. More maintenance and housekeeping, of course. But soldiers can do that. After all, those lazy troopers do nothing but sleep and eat and polish buttons. Do 'em good to have a little regular work. So says the Navy. The real Navy opinion is even more extreme. The Army is obsolete and should be abolished. The Navy doesn't say this officially, but talk to a Navy officer who is on R&R and feeling his oats. You'll get an earful. They think they can fight any war, win it, send a few of their own people down to hold the conquered planet until the diplomatic corps takes charge. I admit that their newest toys can blow any planet right out of the sky. I've never seen it, but I believe it. Maybe I'm as obsolete as Tyrannosaurus Rex. I don't feel obsolete. And us apes can do things that the fanciest ship cannot. If the government doesn't want those things done, no doubt they'll tell us. Maybe it's just as well that neither the Navy nor the MI has the final word. A man can't buck for Sky Marshal unless he's commanded both a regiment and a capital ship, go through MI and take his lumps, and then become a naval officer. I think little Birdie had that in mind. Or first become an astrogator pilot and follow it with Camp Curie, etc. I'll listen respectfully to any man who has done both. Like most transports, the Tours was a mixed ship. The most amazing changes for me was to be allowed north of 30. The bulkhead that separates ladies' country from the rough characters who shave is not necessarily number 30, but by tradition, it is called Bulkhead 30 in any mixed ship. The wardroom is just beyond it, and the rest of the ladies' country is farther forward. In the Tours, the wardroom is also served as messroom for enlisted women, who ate just before we did, and it was partitioned between meals into a recreation room for them and a lounge for their officers. Male officers had a lounge called the card room, just abaft 30. Besides the obvious fact that drop and retrieval require the best pilots, i.e. female, there is very strong reason why female Navy officers were assigned to transports. It is good for trooper morale. Let's skip MI traditions for a moment. Can you think of anything sillier than letting yourself be fired out of a spaceship with nothing but mayhem and sudden death at the other end? However, if someone must do this idiotic stunt, do you know of a surer way to keep a man keyed up to the point where he is willing than by keeping him constantly reminded that the only good reason why men fight is a living, breathing reality? In a mixed ship, the last thing a trooper hears before a drop, maybe the last word he ever hears, is a woman's voice wishing him luck. If you don't think this is important, You've probably resigned from the human race. The tours had 15 naval officers, 8 ladies and 7 men. There were 8 MI officers, including, I am happy to say, myself. I won't say Bulkhead 30 caused me to buck for OCS, but the privilege of eating with the ladies is more incentive than any increase in pay. The skipper was president of the mess. My boss, Captain Blackstone, was vice president. Not because of rank. 3 naval officers ranked him. But as CO of the strike force, he was de facto senior to everybody but the skipper. Every meal was formal. We would wait in the card room until the hour struck, follow Captain Blackstone in and stand behind our chairs. The skipper would come in followed by her ladies, and, as she reached the head of the table, Captain Blackstone would bow and say, Madam President, ladies. And she would answer, Mr. Vice, gentlemen. And the man on each lady's right would seat her. This ritual established that it was a social event, not an officer's conference. Thereafter, ranks or titles were used, except that junior naval officers and myself alone among the MI were called Mr. or Miss, with one exception which fooled me. My first meal aboard, I heard Captain Blackstone called Major, although his shoulder pips plainly read Captain. I got straightened out later. There can't be 2 captains in a Navy vessel, so an Army captain is bumped 1 rank socially, rather than commit the unthinkable of calling him by the title reserved for the one and only monarch. If a naval captain is aboard as anything but skipper, he or she is called Commodore, even if the skipper is a lowly lieutenant. The MI observes this by avoiding the necessity in the wardroom, and paying no attention to the silly custom on our own part of the ship. Seniority ran downhill from each end of the table, with the skipper at the head and the strike force CO at the foot, the junior midshipman at his right, and myself at the skipper's right. I would most happily have sat by the junior midshipman. She was awfully pretty. But the arrangement is planned chaperonage. I never even learned her first name. I knew that I, as the lowliest male, sat on the skipper's right, but I didn't know that I was supposed to seat her. At my first meal, she waited, and nobody sat down, until the 3rd assistant engineer jogged my elbow. I haven't been so embarrassed since a very unfortunate incident in kindergarten, even though Captain Jorgensen acted as if nothing had happened. When the skipper stands up, the meal is over. She was pretty good about this, but once she stayed seated only a few minutes, and Captain Blackstone got annoyed. He stood up, but called out, Captain? She stopped. Yes, Major. Will the captain please give orders that my officers and myself be served in the card room? She answered coldly, Certainly, sir. And we were. But no naval officer joined us. The following Saturday, she exercised her privilege of inspecting the MI aboard, which transport skippers almost never do. However, she simply walked down the ranks without comment. She was not really a martinet, and she had a nice smile when she wasn't being stern. Captain Blackstone assigned Second Lieutenant Rusty Graham to crack the whip over me about math. She found out about it somehow and told Captain Blackstone to have me report to her office for 1 hour after lunch each day. Whereupon she tutored me in math and bawled me out when my homework wasn't perfect. Our 6 platoons were 2 companies in a rump battalion. Captain Blackstone commanded Company D, Blackie's Blackguards, and also commanded the rump battalion. Our battalion commander by the TO, Major Zira, was with A and B companies in the tour's sister ship, Normandy Beach, maybe half a sky away. He commanded us only when the full battalion dropped together, except that Captain Blackie routed certain reports and letters through him. Other materials went directly to fleet, division, or base, and Blackie had a truly wizard fleet sergeant to keep such things straight, and to help him handle both a company and a rump battalion in combat. Administrative details are not simple in any army spread through many light years and hundreds of ships. In the old Valley Forge, in the Roger Young, and now in the Tours, I was in the same regiment. The 3rd Pampered Pets Regiment of the 1st Polaris MI Division. 2 battalions, formed from available units, had been called the 3rd Regiment in Operation Bughouse. But I did not see my regiment. All I saw was PFC Bamberger and a lot of bugs. I might be commissioned in the Pampered Pets, grow old and retire in it, and never even see my regimental commander. The Roughnecks had a company commander, but he also commanded the 1st Platoon, Hornets, in another cravat. I didn't know his name until I saw it on my orders to OCS. There is a legend about a lost platoon that went on R&R as its corvette was decommissioned. Its company commander had just been promoted, and the other platoons had been attached tactically elsewhere. I've forgotten what happened to the platoon's lieutenant, but R&R is a routine time to detach an officer, theoretically after a relief has been sent to understudy him. But reliefs are always scarce. They say this platoon enjoyed a local year of the fleshpots along Churchill Road before anybody missed them. I don't believe it, but it could happen. The chronic scarcity of officers strongly affected my duties in Blackie's Blackguards. The MI has the lowest percentage of officers in any army of record, and this factor is just part of the MI's unique divisional wedge. DW is military jargon, but the idea is simple. If you have 10,000 soldiers, how many fight? And how many just peel potatoes, drive lorries, count graves, and shuffle papers? In the MI, 10,000 men fight. In the mass wars of the 20th century, it sometimes took 70,000 men, fact, to enable 10,000 to fight. I admit it takes the Navy to place us where we fight. However, an MI strike force, even in a corvette, is at least 3 times as large as the transport's Navy crew. It also takes civilians to supply and service us. About 10% of us are on R&R at any time, and a few of the very best of us are rotated to instruct at boot camps. While a few MI are on desk jobs, you will always find that they are shy an arm or leg or some such. These are the ones, the Sergeant Hoes and the Colonel Nielsens, who refuse to retire, and they really ought to count twice, since they release able-bodied MI by filling jobs which require fighting spirit but not physical perfection. They do work that civilians can't do, or we would hire civilians. Civilians are like beans. You buy them as needed for any job which merely requires skill and savvy. But you can't buy fighting spirit. It's scarce. We use all of it, waste none. The MI is the smallest army in history for the size of population it guards. You can't buy an MI. You can't conscript him. You can't coerce him. You can't even keep him if he wants to leave. He can quit 30 seconds before a drop, lose his nerve, and not get into his capsule. And all that happens is that he is paid off and can never vote. At OCS, we studied armies in history that were driven like galley slaves. But the MI is a free man. All that drives him comes from inside. That self-respect and need for the respect of his mates, and his pride in being one of them, called morale, or esprit de corps. The root of our morale is everybody works, everybody fights. An MI doesn't pull strings to get a soft, safe job. There aren't any. Oh, a trooper will get away with what he can. Any private with enough savvy to mark time to music can think up reasons why he should not clean compartments or break out stores. This is a soldier's ancient right. But all soft, safe jobs are filled by civilians. The gold-bricking private climbs into his capsule certain that everybody, from general to private, is doing it with him. Light years away, and on a different day, or maybe an hour or so later, no matter. What does matter is that everybody drops. This is why he enters the capsule, even though he may not be conscious of it. If we ever deviate from this, the MI will go to pieces. All that holds us together is an idea, one that binds more strongly than steel, but its magic power depends on keeping it intact. It is this everybody fights rule that lets the MI get by with so few officers. I know more about this than I want to, because I asked a foolish question in military history and got stuck with an assignment which forced me to dig up stuff ranging from De Bello Gallico to Tsing's classic Collapse of the Golden Hegemony. Consider an ideal MI division. On paper, because you won't find one elsewhere. How many officers does it require? Never mind units attached from other corps. They may not be present during a ruckus. They are not like MI. The special talents attached to logistics and communications are all ranked as officers. If it will make a memory man, a telepath, a sensor, or a lucky man happy to have me salute him, I'm glad to oblige. He is more valuable than I am, and I could not replace him if I lived to be 200. Or take the canine corps, which is 50% officers, but whose other 50% are neo-dogs. None of these is in line of command. So let's consider only us apes and what it takes to lead us. The imaginary division has 10,800 men in 216 platoons, each with a lieutenant. Three platoons to a company calls for 72 captains. Four companies to a battalion calls for 18 majors or lieutenant colonels. Six regiments with six colonels can form two or three brigades, each with a short general, plus a medium-tall general as top brass. You wind up with 317 officers out of a total, all ranks, of 11,117. There are no blank files, and every officer commands a team. Officers total 3%, which is what the MI does have, but arranged somewhat differently. In fact, a good many platoons are commanded by sergeants, and many officers wear more than one hat in order to fill some utterly necessary staff jobs. Even a platoon leader should have staff, his platoon sergeant. But he can get by without one, and his sergeant can get by without him. But a general must have staff. The job is too big to carry in his hat. He needs a big planning staff and a small combat staff. Since there are never enough officers, the team commanders in his flag transport double as his planning staff and are picked from the MI's best mathematical logicians. Then they drop with their own teams. The general drops with a small combat staff, plus a small team of the roughest, on-the-bounce troopers in the MI. Their job is to keep the general from being bothered by rude strangers while he is managing the battle. Sometimes they succeed. Besides necessary staff billets, any team larger than a platoon ought to have a deputy commander. There are never enough officers, so we make do with what we've got. To fill each necessary combat billet, one job to one officer, would call for a 5% ratio of officers. But 3% is all we've got. In place of that optimax of 5% that the MI never can reach, many armies in the past commissioned 10% of their number, or even 15%, and sometimes a preposterous 20%. This sounds like a fairy tale, but it was a fact, especially during the 20th century. What kind of army has more officers than corporals, and more non-coms than privates? An army organized to lose wars, if history means anything. An army that is mostly organization, red tape, and overhead, most of whose soldiers never fight. But what do officers do who do not command fighting men? Fiddlework, apparently. Officers, club officer, morale officer, athletics officer, public information officer, recreation officer, PX officer, transportation officer, legal officer, chaplain, assistant chaplain, junior assistant chaplain, officer in charge of anything anybody can think of, even nursery officer. In the MI, such things are extra duty for combat officers, or if they are real jobs. They are done better and cheaper and without demoralizing a fighting outfit by hiring civilians. But the situation got so smelly in one of the 20th century major powers that real officers, ones who commanded fighting men, were given special insignia to distinguish them from the swarms of swivel-chair hussars. The scarcity of officers got steadily worse as the war wore on, because the casualty rate is always highest among officers, and the MI never commissions a man simply to fill vacancy. In the long run, each boot regiment must supply its own share of officers, and the percentage can't be raised without lowering the standards. The strike force in the Tours needed 13 officers, 6 platoon leaders, 2 company commanders, and 2 deputies, and a strike force commander staffed by a deputy and an adjunct. What it had was 6, and me. Table of Organization, Rump Battalion Strike Force. Captain Blackstone, First Hat, Fleet Sergeant. Company C, Warren's Wolverines. First Lieutenant Warren. First Platoon, First Lieutenant Bayonne. Second Platoon, Second Lieutenant Sucarnaro. Third Platoon, Second Lieutenant Nagain. D Company, Blackie's Blackguards. Captain Blackstone, Second Hat. First Platoon, First Lieutenant Silva, hospitalized. Second Platoon, Second Lieutenant Koroshin. Third Platoon, Second Lieutenant Graham. I would have been under Lieutenant Silva, but he left for the hospital the day I reported, ill with some sort of twitching offals. But this did not necessarily mean that I would get his platoon. A temporary third lieutenant is not considered an asset. Captain Blackstone could place me under Lieutenant Bayonne and put a sergeant in charge of his own first platoon, or even put on a third hat and take the platoon himself. In fact, he did both, and nevertheless assigned me as platoon leader of the first platoon of the Blackguards. He did this by borrowing the Wolverine's best buck sergeant to act as his battalion staffer. Then he placed his fleet sergeant as platoon sergeant of his first platoon, a job 2 grades below his chevrons. Then Captain Blackstone spelled it out for me in a head-shrinking lecture. I would appear on the TO as platoon leader, but Blackie himself and the fleet sergeant would run the platoon. As long as I behaved myself, I could go through the motions. I would even be allowed to drop as platoon leader. But one word from my platoon sergeant to my company commander, and the jaws of the nutcracker would close. It suited me. It was my platoon as long as I could swing it, and if I couldn't, the sooner I was shoved aside, the better for everybody. Besides, it was a lot less nerve-wracking to get a platoon that way than by sudden catastrophe in battle. I took my job very seriously, for it was my platoon. The TO said so. But I had not yet learned to delegate authority, and, for about a week, I was around troopers' country much more than is good for a team. Blackie called me into his stateroom. "Son, what in Ned do you think you're doing?" I answered stiffly that I was trying to get my platoon ready for action. "So? Well, that's not what you are accomplishing. You are stirring them like a nest of wild bees. Why the deuce do you think I turned over to you the best sergeant in the fleet? If you will go to your stateroom, hang yourself on a hook and stay there until 'prepare for action' is sounded, he'll hand that platoon over to you tuned like a violin."
As the captain pleases, sir.
I agreed, glumly. And that's another thing. I can't stand an officer who acts like a confounded cadet. Forget that silly third-person talk around me. Save it for generals and the skipper. Quit bracing your shoulders and clicking your heels. Officers are supposed to look relaxed, son.
Yes, sir.
And let that be the last time you say sir to me for one solid week. Same for saluting. Get that grim cadet look off your face and hang a smile on it.
Yes, sir. Okay.
That's better.
Lean against the bulkhead. Scratch yourself, yawn. Anything but that tin soldier act. I tried, and grinned sheepishly as I discovered that breaking a habit is not easy. Leaning was harder work than standing at attention. Captain Blackstone studied me.
Practice it, he said. An officer can't look scared or tense. It's contagious. Now, tell me, Johnny, what your platoon needs. Never mind the piddling stuff. I'm not interested in whether a man has the regulation number of socks in his locker.
I thought rapidly. Do you happen to know if Lieutenant Silva intended to put Brumby up for sergeant?
I do happen to know. What's your opinion?
Well, the record shows that he has been acting section leader the past 2 months. His efficiency marks are good.
I asked for your recommendation, mister.
Well, sir, sorry. I've never seen him work on the ground, so I can't have a real opinion. Anybody can soldier in the drop room, but the way I see it, he's been acting sergeant too long to bust him back to chaser and promote a squad leader over him. He ought to get that third chevron before we drop, or he ought to be transferred when we get back. Sooner, if there's a chance for a space-side transfer.
Blackie grunted. You're pretty generous in giving away my blackguards for a third lieutenant.
I turned red. Just the same, it's a soft spot in my platoon. Brumby ought to be promoted, or transferred. I don't want him back in his old job with somebody promoted over his head. He'd likely turn sour, and I'd have an even worse soft spot. If he can't have another chevron, he ought to go to Repel Depel for Kadri. Then he won't be humiliated. He gets a fair shake to make sergeant in another team, instead of a dead end here.
Really?
Blackie didn't quite sneer.
After that masterly analysis, apply your powers of deduction and tell me why Lieutenant Silva failed to transfer him 3 weeks ago, when we arrived around Sanctuary.
I had wondered about that. The time to transfer a man is the earliest possible instant after you decide to let him go, and without warning. It's better for the man and the team. So says the book. I said slowly, Was Lieutenant Silva already ill at that time, Captain?
No.
The pieces matched. Captain, I recommend Brumby for immediate promotion. His eyebrows shot up. A minute ago, you were about to dump him as useless.
Not quite. I said it had to be one or the other, but I didn't know which. Now I know.
Continue.
This assumes that Lieutenant Silva was an efficient officer.
Mister, for your information, Quick Silva has an unbroken string of excellent recommended for promotion on his Form 31.
But I knew that he was good, I plowed on, because I inherited a good platoon. A good officer might not promote a man for, many reasons, and still not put his misgivings in writing. But in this case, if he could not recommend him for sergeant, then he wouldn't keep him with the team. So he would get him out of the ship at the first opportunity. But he didn't. Therefore, I know he intended to promote Brumby. I added, But I can't see why he didn't push it through 3 weeks ago so that Brumby could have worn his third chevron on R&R. Captain Blackstone grinned. That's because you don't credit me with being efficient.
Sir, I beg your pardon?
Never mind. You've proved who killed Cock Robin, and I don't expect a still-moist cadet to know all the tricks. But listen and learn, son. As long as this war goes on, don't ever promote a man just before you return to base.
Why not, Captain?
You mentioned sending Brumby to replacement depot if he was not to be promoted. But that's just where he would have gone if we had promoted him 3 weeks ago. You don't know how hungry that non-com desk at Repel Depel is. Paw through the dispatch file and you'll find a demand that we supply 2 sergeants for cadre. With a platoon sergeant being detached for OCS and a buck sergeant spot vacant. I was under compliment, unable to refuse. He grinned savagely. It's a rough war, son, and your own people will steal your best men if you don't watch them. He took 2 sheets of paper out of a drawer. There. One was a letter from Silva to Captain Blackie, recommending Brumby for sergeant. It was dated over a month ago. The other was Brumby's warrant for sergeant, dated the day after they left Sanctuary.
That suit you? He asked.
Huh? Oh, yes, indeed. I've been waiting for you to spot the weak place in your team and tell me what had to be done. I'm pleased that you figured it out, but only middling pleased, because the experienced officer would have analyzed it at once from the TO and the service records. Never mind. That's how you gain experience. Now here's what you do. Write me a letter like Silva's. Date it yesterday. Tell your platoon sergeant to tell Brumby that you have put him up for a 3rd stripe. And don't mention that Silva did so. You didn't know that when you made the recommendation, so we'll keep it that way. When I swear Brumby in, I'll let him know that both his officers recommended him independently, which will make him feel good. Okay? Anything more?
Not in organization, unless Lieutenant Silva planned to promote Naidi, Vice Brumby. In which case, we could promote 1 PFC to Lance, and that would allow us to promote 4 privates to PFC, including 3 vacancies now existing. I don't know whether it's your policy to keep the TO filled up tight or not.
Might as well, Blackie said gently. As you and I know, that some of those lads aren't going to have many days in which to enjoy it. Just remember that we don't make a man a PFC until after he has been in combat. Not in Blackie's blackguards, we don't. Figure it out with your platoon sergeant and let me know. Now hurry. Any time before bedtime tonight. Now, anything else?
Well, Captain, I'm worried about the suits.
So am I. All platoons. I don't know all the other platoons, but with 5 recruits to fit, plus 4 suits damaged and exchanged, and 2 more down-checked this past week and replaced from stores, well, I don't see how Kuna and Navarre can warm up that many and run routine tests on 41 others and get it all done by our calculated date. Even if no trouble develops, that
trouble always develops.
Yes, Captain, but that's 286 man-hours just to warm and fit, plus 123 hours of routine checks, and it always takes longer.
Well, what do you think can be done? The other platoons will lend you help if they finish their suits ahead of time, which I doubt. Don't ask to borrow help from the Wolverines. We're more likely to lend them help.
Captain, I don't know what you'll think of this, since you told me to stay out of troopers' country. But when I was a corporal, I was assistant to the ordnance and armor sergeant.
Keep talking.
Well, right at the last, I was the O&A sergeant, but I was just standing in another man's shoes. I'm not a finished O&A mechanic. But I'm a pretty darn good assistant, and if I was allowed to, well, I could either warm new suits or run routine checks, and give Kona and Navarre that much more time for trouble.
Blackie leaned back and grinned.
Mister, I have searched the regs carefully, and I can't find one that says an officer mustn't get his hands dirty. He added, I mentioned that because some young gentlemen who have been assigned to me apparently had read such a regulation.
All right, draw some dungarees. No need to get your uniform dirty along with your hands. Go aft and find your platoon sergeant. Tell him about Brumby, and order him to prepare recommendations to close the gaps in the TO, in case I should decide to confirm your recommendation for Brumby. Then tell him that you are going to pull in all your time on ordnance and armor, and that you want him to handle everything else. Tell him that if he has any problems, to look you up in the armory. Don't tell him you consulted me. Just give him orders. Follow me?
Yes, sir. Yes, I do.
Okay, get on it. As you pass through the card room, please give my compliments to Rusty and tell him to drag his lazy carcass in here.
For the next 2 weeks, I was never so busy, not even in boot camp. Working as an ordnance and armor mech about 10 hours a day was not all that I did. Math, of course, and no way to duck it with the skipper tutoring me. Meals, say an hour and a half a day, plus the mechanics of staying alive, shaving, showering, putting buttons in uniforms, and trying to chase down the Navy master-at-arms, get him to unlock the laundry to locate clean uniforms 10 minutes before inspection. It is an unwritten law of the Navy that facilities must always be locked when they are most needed. Guard mount, parade, inspections, a minimum of platoon routine, took another hour a day. But besides, I was George. Every outfit has a George. He's the most junior officer and has the extra jobs. Athletics officer, mail censor, referee for competitions, school officer, correspondence courses officer, prosecutor court-martial, treasurer of the Welfare Mutual Loan Fund, custodian of registered publications, stores officer, trooper's mess officer, etc. ad endless nauseam. Rusty Graham had been George until he happily turned it over to me. He wasn't so happy when I insisted on a site inventory of everything for which I had to sign. He suggested that if I didn't have sense enough to accept a commissioned officer's signed inventory, then perhaps a direct order would change my tune. So I got sullen. I told him to put his orders in writing, with a certified copy, so that I could keep the original and endorse the copy over to the team commander. Rusty angrily backed down. Even a second lieutenant isn't stupid enough to put such orders in writing. I wasn't happy either, as Rusty was my roommate and was then still my tutor in math. But we held the site inventory. I got chewed out by Lieutenant Warren for being stupidly officious, but he opened his safe and let me check his registered publications. Captain Blackstone opened his with no comment, and I couldn't tell whether he approved of my site inventory or not. Publications were okay, but accountable property was not. Poor Rusty. He had accepted his predecessor's count, and now the count was short, and the other officer was not merely gone, he was dead. Rusty spent a restless night, and so did I. Then went to Blackie and told him the truth. Blackie chewed him out, then went over the missing items, found ways to expend most of them as lost in combat. It reduced Rusty's shortages to a few days' pay, but Blackie had him keep the job, thereby postponing the cash reckoning indefinitely. Not all George jobs caused that much headache. There were no court-martials. Good combat teams don't have them. There was no mail to censor, as the ship was in Cherenkov Drive. Same for welfare loans for similar reasons. Athletics I delegated to Brumby. Referee was if and when. The trooper's mess was excellent. I initialed menus and sometimes inspected the galley, i.e.,
I scrounged a sandwich without getting out of dungarees when working late in the armory. Correspondence courses meant a lot of paperwork, since quite a few were continuing their educations, war or no war. But I delegated my platoon sergeant, and the records were kept by the PFC, who was his clerk. Nevertheless, George jobs soaked up about 2 hours every day. There were so many. You see where this left me. 10 hours O&A, 3 hours math, meals 1.5 hours, personal 1 hour, military fiddlework 1 hour, George 2 hours, sleep 8 hours. Total, 26.5 hours. The ship wasn't even on the 25-hour sanctuary day. Once we left, we went on Greenwich Standard and the Universal Calendar. The only slack was in my sleeping time. I was sitting in the card room about 1 o'clock one morning, plugging away at math, when Captain Blackstone came in. I said, "Good evening, Captain." "Good morning, you mean. What the deuce ails you, son? Insomnia?"
Not exactly."
He picked up a stack of sheets, remarking, "Can't your sergeant handle your paperwork?"
"Oh, I see. Go to bed."
"But, Captain..."
"Sit back down, Johnny. I've been meaning to talk to you. I never see you here in the card room evenings. I walk past your room, you're at your desk. When your bunkie goes to bed, you move out here. What's the trouble?"
"Well, I just never seem to get caught up."
"Nobody ever does.
How's the work going in the armory?"
"Pretty well. I think we'll make it."
"I think so, too."
"Look, son, you've got to keep a sense of proportion. You have 2 prime duties. First is to see that your platoon's equipment is ready. You're doing that. You don't have to worry about the platoon itself. I told you that. The second, and just as important, you've got to be ready to fight. You're muffing that."
"I'll be ready, Captain."
"Nonsense and other comments. You're getting no exercise and losing sleep. Is that how to train for a drop? When you lead a platoon, son, you've got to be on the bounce. From here on, you will exercise from 1630 to 1800 each day. You will be in your sack with lights out at 2300, and if you lie awake 15 minutes 2 nights in a row, you'll report to the surgeon for treatment. Orders."
"Yes, sir."
I felt the bulkheads closing in on me, and added desperately,
"Captain, I don't see how I can get to bed by 23 and still get everything done."
"Then you won't. As I said, son, you must have a sense of proportion. Tell me how you spend your time."
So I did.
He nodded.
"Just as I thought."
He picked up my math homework, tossed it in front of me.
"Take this.
Sure, you want to work on it, but why work so hard before we go into action?"
"Well, I thought..."
"Think is what you didn't do. There are 4 possibilities, and only one calls for finishing these assignments. First, you might buy a farm. Second, you might buy a small piece and retire with an honorary commission. Third, you might come through all right, but get a down check on your Form 31 from your examiner, namely me, which is just what you're aching for at the present time. Why, son, I won't even let you drop if you show up with eyes red from no sleep and muscles flabby from too much chair parade. The 4th possibility is that you take a grip on yourself, in which case I might let you take a swing at leading a platoon. So let's assume that you do, and put on the finest show since Achilles slew Hector, and I pass you. In that case only, you'll need to finish these math assignments. So do them on the trip back."
"That takes care of that.
I'll tell the skipper. The rest of those jobs you are relieved of right now. On your way home, you can spend your time on math. If we get home. But you'll never get anywhere if you don't learn to keep first things first. Go to bed."
A week later, we made rendezvous, coming out of drive and coasting, short of the speed of light, while the fleet exchanged signals. We were sent briefing, battle plan, our mission and orders, a stack of words as long as a novel, and were told not to drop. Oh, we were to be in the operation, but we would ride down like gentlemen, cushioned in retrieval boats. This we could do because the Federation already held the surface. 2nd, 3rd, and 5th MI divisions had taken it and paid cash. The described real estate didn't seem worth the price. Planet P is smaller than Terra, with a surface gravity of 0.7, is mostly Arctic cold ocean and rock, with lichenous flora and no fauna of interest. Its air is not breathable for long, being contaminated with nitrous oxide and too much ozone. Its one continent is about half the size of Australia, plus many worthless islands. It would probably require as much terraforming as Venus before we could use it. However, we were not buying real estate to live on. We went there because bugs were there. And they were there on our account, so staff thought. Staff told us that Planet P was an uncomplimented advance base, probability 87%, plus or minus 6%, to be used against us. Since the planet was no prize, the routine way to get rid of this bug base would be for the Navy to stand off at a safe distance and render this ugly spheroid uninhabitable by man or bug. But the CNC had other ideas. The operation was a raid. It sounds incredible to call a battle involving hundreds of ships and thousands of casualties a raid, especially as, in the meantime, the Navy and a lot of other cap troopers were keeping things stirred up many light years into bug space in order to divert them from reinforcing Planet P. But the CNC was not wasting men. This giant raid could determine who won the war, whether next year or 30 years hence. We needed to learn more about bug psychology. Must we wipe out every bug in the galaxy? Or was it possible to trounce them and impose a peace? We did not know. We understood them as little as we understood termites. To learn their psychology, we had to communicate with them, learn their motivations, find out why they fought, and under what conditions they would stop. For these, the Psychological Warfare Corps needed prisoners. Workers are easy to capture, but a bug worker is hardly more than animate machinery. Warriors can be captured by burning off enough limbs to make them helpless, but they are almost as stupid without a director as workers. From such prisoners, our professor types had learned important matters. The development of that oily gas that killed them, but not us, came from analyzing the biochemistries of the workers and warriors. And we had had other new weapons from such research, even in the short time I had been a cap trooper. But to discover why bugs fight, we needed to study members of their brain cast. Also, we hoped to exchange prisoners. So far, we had never taken a brain bug alive. We had either cleaned out colonies from the surface, as on Sheol, or, as had too often been the case, raiders had gone down their holes and not come back. A lot of brave men had been lost this way. Still more had been lost through retrieval failure. Sometimes a team on the ground had its ship, or ships, knocked out of the sky. What happens to such a team? Possibly it dies to the last man. More probably, it fights until power and ammo are gone. Then survivors are captured as easily as so many beetles on their backs. From our co-belligerents, the Skinnies, we knew that many missing troopers were alive as prisoners. Thousands, we hoped. Hundreds, we were sure. Intelligence believed that prisoners were always taken to Klendathu. The bugs are as curious about us as we are about them. A race of individuals able to build cities, starships, armies, may be even more mysterious to a hive entity than a hive entity is to us. As may be, we wanted those prisoners back. In the grim logic of the universe, this may be a weakness. Perhaps some race that never bothers to rescue an individual may exploit this human trait to wipe us out. The skinnies have such a trait only slightly, and the bugs don't seem to have it at all. Nobody ever saw a bug come to the aid of another because he was wounded. They cooperate perfectly in fighting, but units are abandoned the instant they are no longer useful. Our behavior is different. How often have you seen a headline like this? 2 die attempting rescue of drowning child. If a man gets lost in the mountains, hundreds will search, and often 2 or 3 searchers are killed. But the next time somebody gets lost, just as many volunteers turn out. Poor arithmetic, but very human. It runs through all our folklore, all human religions, all our literature. A racial conviction that when one human needs rescue, others should not count the price. Weakness? It might be the unique strength that wins us the galaxy. Weakness or strength, bugs don't have it. There was no prospect of trading fighters for fighters. But in a hive polyarchy, some castes are valuable, or so our psych warfare people hoped. If we could capture brain bugs, alive and undamaged, we might be able to trade on good terms. And suppose we captured a queen? What is a queen's trading value? A regiment of troopers? Nobody knew. But battle plan ordered us to capture bug royalty, brains and queens, at any cost, on the gamble that we could trade them for human beings. The third purpose of Operation Royalty was to develop methods, how to go down, how to dig them out, how to win with less than total weapons. Trooper for warrior, we could not defeat them above ground. Ship for ship, our navy was better. But so far, we had had no luck when we tried to go down their holes. If we failed to exchange prisoners on any terms, then we still had to A. win the war, B. do so in a way that gave us a fighting chance to rescue our own people, or C. might as well admit it, die trying and lose. Planet P was a field test to determine whether we could learn how to root them out. Briefing was read to every trooper, and he heard it again in his sleep during hypno preparation. So, while we all knew that Operation Royalty was laying the groundwork toward eventual rescue of our mates, we also knew that Planet P held no human prisoners. It had never been raided. So there was no reason to buck for medals in a wild hope of being personally in on a rescue. It was just another bug hunt, but conducted with massive force and new techniques. We were going to peel that planet like an onion until we knew that every bug had been dug out. The Navy plastered the islands and that unoccupied part of the continent until they were radioactive glaze. We could tackle the bugs with no worries about our rear. The Navy also maintained a ball of yarn patrol in tight orbits around the planet, guarding us, escorting transports, keeping a spy watch on the surface to make sure that bugs did not break out behind us despite that plastering. Under the battle plan, the orders for Blackie's Blackguards charged us with supporting the prime mission when ordered or as opportunity presented. Relieving another company in a captured area, protecting units of other corps in that area, maintaining contact with MI units around us, and smacking down any bugs that showed their ugly heads. So we rode down in comfort to an unopposed landing. I took my platoon out at a power-armored trot. Blackie went ahead to meet the company commander he was relieving, get the situation and size up the terrain. He headed for the horizon like a scared jackrabbit. I had Kuna send his first section scouts out to locate the forward corners of my patrol area, and I sent my platoon sergeant off to my left to make contact with the patrol from the 5th Regiment. We, the 3rd Regiment, had a grid 300 miles wide and 80 miles deep to hold.
My piece was a rectangle 40 miles deep and 17 wide in the extreme left flank, forward corner. The Wolverines were behind us, Lieutenant Kuroshin's platoon on the right and Rusty beyond him. Our 1st Regiment had already relieved a 5th Division regiment ahead of us, with a brick wall overlap that placed them on my corner as well as ahead. Ahead and rear, right flank and left, referred to orientation set up in dead reckoning tracers in each command suit to match the grid of the battle plan. We had no true front, simply an area, and the only fighting at the moment was going on several hundred miles away, to our arbitrary right and rear. Somewhere off that way, probably 200 miles, should be 2nd Platoon, G Company, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Regiment, commonly known as the Roughnecks. Or the Roughnecks might be 40 light-years away. Tactical organization never matches the table of organization. All I knew from the plan was that something called the 2nd Battalion was on our right flank, beyond the boys from the Normandy beach. But that battalion could have been borrowed from another division. The Sky Marshal plays his chess without consulting the pieces. Anyhow, I should not be thinking about the Roughnecks. I had all I could do as a blackguard. My platoon was okay, for the moment, safe as you can be on a hostile planet. But I had plenty to do before Kuna's 1st squad reached the far corner. I needed to, 1, locate the platoon leader who had been holding my area, 2, establish corners and identify them to section and squad leaders, 3, make contact liaison with 8 platoon leaders on my sides and corners, 5 of whom should already be in position, those from 5th and 1st regiments, and 3, Kuroshin of the Blackguards and Bayonne and Sukarno of the Wolverines, who were now moving into position. 4, get my own boys spread out to their initial points as fast as possible by shortest routes. The last had to be set up first, as the open column in which we disembarked would not do it. Brumby's last squad needed to deploy to the left flank. Kona's leading squad needed to spread from dead ahead to left oblique. The other 4 squads must fan out in between. This is a standard square deployment, and we had simulated how to reach it quickly in the drop room. I called out, "Kuna, Brumby, time to spread 'em out," using the non-com circuit. "Roger, Sec 1. "Roger, Sec 2. "Section leaders take charge, and caution each recruit. You'll be passing a lot of cherubs. I don't want 'em shot at by mistake." I bit down from my private circuit and said, "Sarge, you got contact on the left?" "Yes, sir, they see me. They see you." "Good. I don't see a beacon on our anchor corner." "Missing." "So you, Coach Kuna, by DR, same for the lead scout, that's Hughes, and have Hughes set a new beacon." I wondered why the 3rd or 5th hadn't replaced that anchor beacon, my forward left corner, where 3 regiments came together. "No use talking," I went on. "DR check. You bear 275, miles 12. "Sir, reverse is 96, miles 12 scant." "Close enough. I haven't found my opposite number yet, so I'm cutting out forward at max. Mind the shop." "Got him, Mr. Rico." I advanced at max speed while clicking over to officer circuit. "Square Black 1, answer." "Black 1, Chang's Cherubs, do you read me? Answer." I wanted to talk with the leader of the platoon we were relieving, and not for any perfunctory, "I relieve you, sir." I wanted the ungarnished word. I didn't like what I had seen. Either the top brass had been optimistic in believing that we had mounted overwhelming force against a small, not fully developed bug base, or the blackguards had been awarded the spot where the roof fell in. In the few moments I had been out of the boost, I had spotted 6 armored suits on the ground. Empty, I hoped. Dead men, possibly. But way too many, any way you looked at it.
Besides that, my tactical radar display showed a full platoon, my own, moving into position, but only a scattering moving back toward retrieval, or still on station. Nor could I see any system to their movements. I was responsible for 680 square miles of hostile terrain, and I wanted very badly to find out all I could before my own squads were deep into it. Battleplan had ordered a new tactical doctrine, which I found dismaying. Do not close the bug tunnels. Blackie had explained this as if it had been his own happy thought, but I doubt if he liked it. The strategy was simple, and I guess logical, if we could afford the losses. Let the bugs come up. Meet them and kill them on the surface. Let them keep on coming up. Don't bomb their holes, don't gas their holes. Let them out. After a while, a day, 2 days, a week, if we really did have overwhelming force, they would stop coming up. Planning staff estimated, don't ask me how, that the bugs would expend 70% to 90% of their warriors before they stopped trying to drive us off the surface. Then we would start the unpeeling, killing surviving warriors as we went down and trying to capture royalty alive. We knew what the brain cast looked like. We had seen them dead in photographs, and we knew they could not run, barely functioning legs, bloated bodies that were mostly nervous system. Queens no human had ever seen, but BioWar Corps had prepared sketches of what they should look like. Obscene monsters, larger than a horse, and utterly immobile. Besides brains and queens, there might be other royalty castes. As might be, encourage their warriors to come out and die, then capture alive anything but warriors and workers. A necessary plan and very pretty on paper. What it meant to me was that I had an area 17 by 40 miles which might be riddled with unstoppable bug holes. I wanted coordinates on each one. If there were too many, well, I might accidentally plug a few and let my boys concentrate on watching the rest. A private in a marauder suit can cover a lot of terrain, but he can look at only one thing at a time. He is not superhuman. I bounced several miles ahead of the first squad, still calling the cherub platoon leader, varying it by calling any cherub officer and describing the pattern of my transponder beacon. Da-dee-da-da. No answer. At last I got a reply from my boss. Johnny, knock off the noise. Answer me on conference circuit. So I did. And Blackie told me crisply to quit trying to find the cherub leader for Square Black One. There wasn't one. Oh, there might be a non-com alive somewhere, but the chain of command had been broken. By the book, somebody always moves up. But it does happen if too many links are knocked out. As Colonel Nielsen had once warned me in the dim past, almost a month ago. Captain Chang had gone into action with three officers besides himself. There was one left now, my classmate, Abe Mose. And Blackie was trying to find out from him the situation. Abe wasn't much help. When I joined the conference and identified myself, Abe thought I was his battalion commander and made a report almost heartbreakingly precise, especially as it made no sense at all. Blackie interrupted and told me to carry on. Forget about a relief briefing. The situation is whatever you see that it is, so stir around and see. Right, boss. I slashed across my own area toward the far corner, the anchor corner, as fast as I could move, switching circuits on my first bounce. Sarge, how about that beacon? No place on that corner to put it, sir. A fresh crater there, about scale 6. I whistled to myself. You could drop the tours into a size 6 crater. One of the dodges the bugs used on us when we were sparring, ourselves on the surface, bugs underground, was landmines. They never seemed to use missiles, except from ships in space. If you were near the spot, the ground shot got you. If you were in the air when it went off, the concussion wave could tumble your gyros and throw your suit out of control. I had never seen larger than a scale 4 crater. The theory was that they didn't dare use too big an explosion because of damage to their troglodyte habitats, even if they cofferdammed around them.
Place an offset beacon, I told him. Tell section and squad leaders.
I have, sir. Angle 110, miles 1.3. Da de dit. You should be able to read it. Bearing about 335 from where you are. He sounded as calm as a sergeant instructor at drill, and I wondered if I were letting my voice get shrill. I found it on my display, above my left eyebrow, long and two shorts.
Okay. I see Kuna's first squad is nearing a position. Break off that squad, have it patrol the crater. Equalize the areas. Brumby will have to take 4 more miles of depth.
I thought with annoyance that each man already had to patrol 14 square miles. Spreading the butter so thin meant 17 square miles per man, and a bug can come out of a hole less than 5 feet wide. I added, "How hot is that crater?"
"Amber red at the edges. I haven't been in it, sir."
"Stay out of it, I'll check it later." Amber red would kill an unprotected human, but a trooper in armor can take it for quite a time. If there was that much radiation at the edge, the bottom would no doubt fry your eyeballs. Tell Naidi to pull Milan and Bjork back to Amber Zone, and have them set up ground listeners. 2 of my 5 recruits were in that first squad, and recruits are like puppies. They stick their noses into things. Tell Naidi that I am interested in 2 things. Movement inside the crater, and noises in the ground around it. We wouldn't send troopers out through a hole so radioactive that mere exit would kill them. But bugs would, if they could reach us that way. Have Naidi report to me.
To you and me, I mean.
Yes, sir, my platoon sergeant added. May I make a suggestion?
Of course, and don't stop to ask permission next time.
Navar can handle the rest of the first section. Sergeant Kuna could take the squad at the crater and leave Naidi free to supervise the ground listening watch. I knew what he was thinking. Naidi, so newly a corporal that he had never before had a squad on the ground, was hardly the man to cover what looked like the worst danger point in Square Black One. He wanted to pull Naidi back for the same reason I had pulled the recruits back. I wondered if he knew what I was thinking. That nutcracker, he was using the suit he had worn as Blackie's battalion staffer, he had one more circuit than I had, a private one, to Captain Blackstone. Blackie was probably patched in and listening via that extra circuit. Obviously, my platoon sergeant did not agree with my disposition of the platoon. If I didn't take his advice, the next thing I heard might be Blackie's voice cutting in. "Sergeant, take charge. Mr. Rico, you're relieved." But, confound it, a corporal who wasn't allowed to boss his squad wasn't a corporal, and a platoon leader who was just a ventriloquist's dummy for his platoon sergeant was an empty suit. I didn't mull this. It flashed through my head, and I answered at once. I can't spare a corporal to babysit with 2 recruits, nor a sergeant to boss 4 privates and a lance. But hold it. I want the crater watch relieved every hour. I want our first patrol sweep made rapidly. Squad leaders will check any hole reported and get beacon bearings so that section leaders, platoon sergeant, and platoon leader can check them as they reach them. If there aren't too many, we'll put a watch on each. I'll decide later.
Yes, sir.
Second time around, I want a slow patrol, as tight as possible, and catch holes we miss on the first sweep. Assistant squad leaders will use snoopers on that pass. Squad leaders will get bearings on any troopers or suits on the ground. The cherubs may have left some live wounded, but no one is to stop even to check physicals until I order it. We've got to know the bug situation first.
Yes, sir.
Suggestions?
Just one, he answered. I think the squad chasers should use their snoopers on that first fast pass.
Very well, do it that way.
His suggestion made sense, as the surface air temperature was much lower than the bugs use in their tunnels. A camouflage vent hole would show a plume like a geyser by infrared vision. I glanced at my display. Kona's boys are almost at limit. Start your parade.
Very well, sir.
Off. I clicked over to the wide circuit and continued to make tracks for the crater while I listened to everybody at once, as my platoon sergeant revised the pre-plan, cutting out one squad, heading it for the crater, starting the rest of the first section in a two-squad countermarch, while keeping the second section in rotational sweep as pre-planned but with 4 miles increased depth. Got the sections moving, dropped them and caught the first squad as it converged on the anchor crater, gave it its instructions, cut back to the section leaders and plenty of time to give them new beacon bearings at which to make their turns. He did it with the smart precision of a drum major on parade, and he did it faster and in fewer words than I could have done it. Extended order powered suit drill, with a platoon spread over many miles of countryside, is much more difficult than the strutting precision of parade. But it has to be exact, or you'll blow the head off your mate in action. Or, as in this case, you sweep part of the terrain twice and miss another part. But the drill master has only a radar display of his formation. He can see with his eyes only those near him. While I listened, I watched it on my own display. Glowworms crawling past my face in precise lines. Crawling, because even 40 miles an hour is a slow crawl when you can press a formation 20 miles across into a display a man can see. I listened to everybody at once because I wanted to hear the chatter inside the squads. There wasn't any. Kuna and Brumby gave their secondary commands and shut up. The corporal sang out only as squad changes were necessary. Section and squad chasers called out occasional corrections of interval or alignment, and privates said nothing at all. I heard the breathing of 50 men like muted sibilants of surf, broken only by necessary orders in the fewest possible words. Blackie had been right. The platoon had been handed over to me tuned like a violin. They didn't need me. I could go home and my platoon would get along just as well. Maybe better. I wasn't sure I had been right in refusing to cut Kuna out to guard the crater. If trouble broke out there, and those boys couldn't be reached in time, the excuse that I had done it by the book was worthless. If you get killed or let somebody else get killed, by the book, it's just as permanent as any other way. I wondered if the Roughnecks had a spot open for a buck sergeant. Most of Square Black One was as flat as the prairie around Camp Curie, and much more barren. For this, I was thankful. It gave us our only chance to spot a bug coming up from below and get him first. We were spread so widely that 4 mile intervals between men, and about 6 minutes between waves of a fast sweep, was as tight a patrol as we could manage. This isn't tight enough. Any one spot would remain free of observation for at least 3 or 4 minutes between patrol waves, and a lot of bugs can come out of a very small hole in 3 to 4 minutes. Radar can see farther than the eye, of course, but it cannot see as accurately. In addition, we did not dare use anything but short-range selective weapons. Our own mates were spread around us in all directions. If a bug popped up and you let fly with something lethal, it was certain that not too far beyond that bug was a cap trooper. This sharply limits the range and force of the frightfulness you dare use. On this operation, only officers and platoon sergeants were armed with rockets, and even so, we did not expect to use them. If a rocket fails to find its target, it has a nasty habit of continuing to search until it finds one. And it cannot tell a friend from a foe. A brain that can be stuffed into a small rocket is fairly stupid. I would happily have swapped that area patrol with thousands of MI around us for a simple one platoon strike in which you know where your own people are and anything else is an enemy target.
I didn't waste time moaning. I never stopped bouncing toward that anchor corner crater, while watching the ground and trying to watch the radar picture as well. I didn't find any bug holes, but I did jump over a dry wash, almost a canyon, which could conceal quite a few. I didn't stop to see. I simply gave its coordinates to my platoon sergeant and told him to have somebody check it. That crater was even bigger than I had visualized. The tours would have been lost in it. I shifted my radiation counter to directional cascade, took readings on floor and sides, red to multiple red right off the scale. Very unhealthy for long exposure, even to a man in armor. I estimated its width and depth by helmet rangefinder, then prowled around and tried to spot openings leading underground. I did not find any, but I did run into crater watches set out by adjacent platoons of the 5th and 1st regiments. So I arranged to split up the watch by sectors, such that the combined watch could yell for help from all three platoons. The patch end to do this being made through 1st Lieutenant Do de Campo of the Headhunters on our left. Then I pulled out Naidi's lance and half his squad, including the recruits, and sent them back to platoon, reporting all this to my boss and to my platoon sergeant. "Captain," I told Blackie, "we aren't getting any ground vibrations. I'm going down inside and check for holes. The readings show that I won't get too much dosage if I..." "Youngster, stay out of that crater." "But Captain, I just meant to..." "Shut up. You can't learn anything useful. Stay out." "Yes, sir." The next 9 hours were tedious. We had been preconditioned for 40 hours of duty, 2 revolutions of Planet P, through forced sleep, elevated blood sugar count, and hypno-indoctrination, and of course the suits are self-contained for personal needs. The suits can't last that long, but each man was carrying extra power units and super HP air cartridges for recharging. But a patrol with no action is dull. It is easy to goof off. I did what I could think of, having Kona and Brumby take turn as drill sergeant, thus leaving platoon sergeant and leader free to rove around. I gave orders that no sweeps were to repeat in pattern, so that each man would always check terrain that was new to him. There were endless patterns to cover in a given area by combining the combinations. Besides that, I consulted my platoon sergeant and announced bonus points toward honor squad for first verifiable hole, first bug destroyed, etc. Boot camp tricks. But staying alert means staying alive. So anything to avoid boredom. Finally, we had a visit from a special unit. 3 combat engineers in a utility air car, escorting a talent, a spatial sensor. Blackie warned me to expect them. "Protect them and give them what they want." "Yes, sir. What will they need?"
"How should I know? If Major Landry wants you to take off your skin and dance in your bones, do it."
"Yes, sir. Major Landry." I relayed the word and set up a bodyguard by sub-areas. Then I met them as they arrived because I was curious. I had never seen a spatial talent at work. They landed beside my right flank and got out. Major Landry and 2 officers were wearing armor and hand flamers, but the talent had no armor and no weapons, just an oxygen mask. He was dressed in a fatigue uniform without insignia, and he seemed terribly bored by everything. I was not introduced to him. He looked like a 16-year-old boy, until I got close and saw a network of wrinkles around his weary eyes. As he got out, he took off his breathing mask. I was horrified, so I spoke to Major Landry, helmet to helmet, without radio. "Major, the air around here is hot. Besides that, we've been warned that..."
"Pipe down," said the Major. "He knows it."
I shut up. The talent strolled a short distance, turned, and pulled his lower lip. His eyes were closed, and he seemed to be lost in thought. He opened them and said fretfully, "How can one be expected to work with all those silly people jumping around?"
Major Landry said crisply. Ground your platoon.
I gulped and started to argue, then cut in the all-hands circuit. First platoon, blackguards, ground and freeze.
It spells well for Lieutenant Silva that all I heard was a double echo of my order as it was repeated down to squad. I said, Major, can I let them move around on the ground?
No, and shut up.
Presently, the sensor got back in the car, put his mask on. There wasn't room for me, but I was allowed, ordered really, to grab on and be towed. We shifted a couple of miles. Again, the sensor took off his mask and walked around. This time, he spoke to one of the other combat engineers, who kept nodding and sketching on a pad. The special mission unit landed about a dozen times in my area, each time going through the same apparently pointless routine. Then they moved on into the 5th Regiment's grid. Just before they left, the officer who had been sketching pulled a sheet out of the bottom of his sketchbox and handed it to me.
Here's your submap. The wide red band is the only bug boulevard in your area. It is nearly 1,000 feet down where it enters, but it climbs steadily toward your left rear and leaves at about -450. The light blue network joining it is a big bug colony. The only place is where it comes within 100 feet of the surface I have marked. You might put some listeners there until we can get over there to handle it.
I stared at it.
Is this map reliable?
The engineer officer glanced at the sensor, then said very quietly to me, Of course it is, you idiot. What are you trying to do, upset him? They left while I was studying it. The artist engineer had done double sketching, and the box had combined them into a stereo picture of the 1,000 feet under the surface. I was so bemused by it that I had to be reminded to take the platoon out of freeze. Then I withdrew the ground listeners from the crater, pulled 2 men from each squad, and gave them bearings from the infernal map to have them listen along the bug highway and over the town. I reported it to Blackie. He cut me off as I started to describe the bug tunnels by coordinates. Major Landry relayed a facsimile to me. Just give me coordinates of your listening posts. I did so. He said, Not bad, Johnny, but not quite what I want either. You've placed more listeners than you need over their mapped tunnels. String 4 of them along that bug racetrack. Place 4 more in a diamond around their town. That leaves you 4. Place 1 in the triangle formed by your right rear corner and the main tunnel. The other 3 go in the larger area on the other side of the tunnel.
Yes, sir.
I added, Captain, can we depend on this map?
What's troubling you?
Well, it seems like magic. Black magic.
Oh. Look, son, I've got a special message from the Sky Marshal to you. He says to tell you that map is official, and that he will worry about everything else, so that you can give full time to your platoon. Follow me?
Yes, Captain.
But the bugs can burrow mighty fast, so you give special attention to the listening posts outside the area of the tunnels. Any noise from those 4 outside posts louder than a butterfly's roar is to be reported at once, regardless of its nature.
Yes, sir.
When they burrow, it makes a noise like frying bacon, in case you've never heard it. Stop your patrol sweeps. Leave 1 man on visual observation of the crater. Let half your platoon sleep for 2 hours, while the other half pairs off to take turns listening.
Yes, sir.
You may see some more combat engineers. Here's the revised plan. A sapper company will blast down and cork that main tunnel where it comes nearest the surface, either at your left flank or beyond in headhunter territory. At the same time, another engineering company will do the same where that tunnel branches about 30 miles off to your right, in the 1st Regiment's bailiwick. When the corks are in, a long chunk of their main street and a biggish settlement will be cut off. Meanwhile, the same sort of thing will be going on a lot of other places,
Thereafter, we'll see. Either the bugs break through to the surface and we have a pitch battle, or they sit tight and we go down after them, a sector at a time.
I see. I wasn't sure that I did, but I understood my part. Rearrange my listening posts. Let half my platoon sleep. Then a bug hunt. On the surface, if we're lucky. Underground, if we had to.
Have your flank make contact with that sapper company when it arrives. Help them if they want help.
Right, Captain.
I agreed heartily. Combat engineers are almost as good an outfit as the infantry. It's a pleasure to work with them. In a pinch, they fight. Maybe not expertly, but bravely. Or they go ahead with their work, not even lifting their heads while a battle rages around them. They have an unofficial, very cynical, and very ancient motto. First we dig 'em, then we die in 'em. To supplement their official motto, can do. Both mottos are literal truth.
Get on it, son.
12 listening posts meant that I could put a half a squad at each post, either a corporal or his lance, plus 3 privates, then allow 2 of each group of 4 to sleep while the other 2 took turns listening. Navarre and the other section chaser could watch the crater and sleep, turn about, while section sergeants could take turns in charge of the platoon. The disposition took no more than 10 minutes once I had detailed the plan and given out bearings to the sergeants. Nobody had to move very far. I warned everybody to keep eyes open for a company of engineers. As soon as each section reported its listening posts in operation, I clicked to the wide circuit. Odd numbers, lie down. Prepare to sleep. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, sleep. A suit is not a bed, but it will do. One good thing about hypno-preparation for combat is that, in the unlikely event of a chance to rest, a man can be put to sleep instantly by post-hypnotic command triggered by someone who is not a hypnotist, and awakened just as instantly, alert and ready to fight. It is a lifesaver, because a man can get so exhausted in battle that he shoots at things that aren't there and can't see what he should be fighting. But I had no intention of sleeping. I had not been told to, and I had not asked. The very thought of sleeping, when I knew that perhaps many thousands of bugs were only a few hundred feet away, made my stomach jump. Maybe that sensor was infallible. Perhaps the bugs could not reach us without alerting our listening posts. Maybe. But I didn't want to chance it. I clicked to my private circuit. Sarge?
Yes, sir.
You might as well get a nap. I'll be on watch. Lie down and prepare to sleep. 1, 2...
Excuse me, sir, I have a suggestion.
Yes?
If I understand the revised plan, no action is expected for the next 4 hours. You could take a nap now, and then...
Forget it, Sarge. I am not going to sleep. I'm going to make the rounds of the listening posts and watch for that sapper company.
Very well, sir.
I'll check number 3 while I'm here. You stay here with Brumby and catch some rest while I...
Johnny?
I broke off.
Yes, Captain.
Had the old man been listening?
Are your posts all set?
Yes, Captain, and my odd numbers are sleeping. I am about to inspect each post. Then,
let your sergeant do it. I want you to rest.
But, Captain, lie down. That's a direct order. Prepare to sleep. 1, 2, 3.
Johnny?
Captain, with your permission, I would like to inspect my posts first. Then I'll rest, if you say so. But I would rather remain awake.
Blackie guffawed in my ear.
Look, son, you've slept for 1 hour and 10 minutes.
Sir?
Check the time.
I did so, and felt foolish.
You wide awake, son?
Yes, sir, I think so.
Things have speeded up. Call your odd numbers and put your even numbers to sleep. With luck, they may get 1 hour. So swap 'em around,
Inspect your posts and call me back.
I did so and started my rounds without a word to my platoon sergeant. I was annoyed at both him and Blackie, at my company commander because I resented being put to sleep against my wishes, and as for my platoon sergeant, I had a dirty hunch that it wouldn't have been done if he weren't the real boss, and myself just a figurehead. But after I had checked posts number 3 and 1, no sounds of any sort, both were forward of the bug area, I cooled down. After all, blaming a sergeant, even a fleet sergeant, for something a captain did was silly.
Sarge?
Yes, Mr. Rico.
Do you want to catch a nap with the even numbers? I'll wake you up a minute or two before I wake them.
He hesitated slightly. Sir, I'd like to inspect the listening posts myself.
Haven't you already?
No, sir, I've been asleep the past hour.
Huh?
He sounded embarrassed.
The captain required me to do so. He placed Brumby temporarily in charge and put me to sleep immediately after he relieved you.
I started to answer, then laughed helplessly.
Sarge, let you and I go off somewhere and go back to sleep. We're wasting our time. Captain Blackie is running this platoon.
I have found, sir, he answered stiffly, that Captain Blackstone invariably has a reason for anything he does.
I nodded thoughtfully, forgetting that I was 10 miles from my listener.
Yes, you're right. He always has a reason. Since he had us both asleep, he must want both of us awake and alert now.
I think that must be true.
Any idea why?
He was rather long in answering.
Mr. Rico, he said slowly, if the captain knew, he would tell us. I've never known him to hold back information, but sometimes he does things a certain way without being able to explain why. The captain's hunches, well, I've learned to respect them.
So, squad leaders are all even numbers?
They're asleep.
Yes, sir.
Alert the lance of each squad. I won't wake anybody, but when we do, seconds may be important.
Right away.
I checked the remaining forward posts, then covered the four posts bracketing the bug village, jacking my phones in parallel with each listener. I had to force myself to listen because you could hear them, down there below, chittering to each other. I wanted to run. And it was all I could do not to let it show. I wondered if that special talent was simply a man with incredibly acute hearing.
Well, no matter how he did it, the bugs were where he said they were.
Back at OCS, we had received demonstrations of recorded bug noises. These four posts were picking up typical nest noises of a large bug town, that chittering which may be their speech. Though why should they need to talk if they are all remotely controlled by the braincast? A rustling like sticks and dry leaves, a high background whine, which is always heard at a settlement, and which had to be machinery. Their air conditioning, perhaps. I did not hear the hissing, crackling noise they make in cutting through rock. The sounds along the Bug Boulevard were unlike the settlement sounds, a low background rumble which increased to a roar every few moments, as if heavy traffic were passing. I listened to post number 5, then got an idea. Checked it by having the standby man at each of the four posts along the tunnel call out "Mark" to me each time the roar got loudest. Presently I reported.
Captain?
Yeah, Johnny.
The traffic along this bug race is all moving one way, from me toward you. Speed is approximately 110 miles an hour. A load goes past about once a minute.
Close enough, he agreed. I make it 108 with a headway of 58 seconds.
Oh. I felt dashed and changed the subject.
I haven't seen that sapper company.
You won't.
They picked a spot in the middle rear of Headhunter area.
Sorry, I should have told you. Anything more?
No, sir.
We clicked off and I felt better. Even Blackie could forget. And there hadn't been anything wrong with my idea. I left the tunnel zone to inspect the listening post to right and rear of the bug area. Post 12. As with the others, there were two men asleep, one listening, one standby. I said to the standby, "Getting anything?"
"No, sir."
The man listening, one of my five recruits, looked up and said, "Mr. Rico, I think this pickup has just gone sour." "I'll check it," I said. He moved to let me jack in with him. Frying bacon, so loud you could smell it. I hit the all-hands circuit. "First platoon, up, wake up, call off, and report." And clicked over to officer circuit. "Captain, Captain Blackstone, urgent." "Slow down, Johnny, report." "Frying bacon sounds, sir," I answered, trying desperately to keep my voice steady. "Post 12, at coordinates Easter 9, square black 1.
"Easter 9, he agreed.
"Decibels?" I looked hastily at the meter on the pickup. "I don't know, Captain. Off the scale at the max end. It sounds like they're right under my feet." "Good," he applauded. And I wondered how he could feel that way.
"Best news we've heard today. Now listen, son, get your lads awake."
"They are, sir."
"Very well. Pull back two listeners. Have them spot check around post 12. Try to figure where the bugs are going to break out and stay away from that spot. Understand me?"
"I hear you, sir," I said carefully. "But I do not understand." He sighed. "Johnny, you'll turn my hair gray yet. Look, son, we want them to come out. The more, the better. You don't have the firepower to handle them, other than by blowing up the tunnel as they reach the surface. And that is the one thing you must not do. If they come out in force, a regiment can't handle them. And that's just what the general wants. And he's got a brigade of heavy weapons in orbit, waiting for it. So you spot that breakthrough, fall back and keep it under observation. If you're lucky enough to have a major breakthrough in your area, your reconnaissance will be patched through all the way to the top. So stay lucky and stay alive, got it?"
"Yes, sir.
Spot the breakthrough, fall back and avoid contact. Observe and report."
"Get on it."
I pulled back listeners 9 and 10 from the middle stretch of Bug Boulevard and had them close in on coordinates Easter 9 from right and left, stopping every half mile to listen for frying bacon. At the same time, I lifted post 12 and moved it toward our rear, while checking for a dying away of the sound. In the meantime, my platoon sergeant was regrouping the platoon in the forward area between the bug settlement and the crater, all but 12 men who were ground listening. Since we were under orders not to attack, we both worried over the prospect of having the platoon spread too widely for mutual support. So he rearranged them in a compact line 5 miles long, with Brumby's section on the left, nearer the bug settlement. This placed the men less than 300 yards apart, almost shoulder to shoulder for cap troopers, and put 9 of the men still on listening stations within support distance of one flank or the other. Only the 3 listeners working with me were out of reach of ready help. I told Bayonne of the Wolverines and DeCampo of the Headhunters that I was no longer patrolling in Y, and I reported our regrouping to Captain Blackstone. He grunted, "Suit yourself." "Got a prediction on that breakthrough?"
"It seems to center about Easter 10, Captain, but it is hard to pin down. The sounds are very loud in an area about 3 miles across, and it seems to get wider. I'm trying to circle it at an intensity level just barely on scale."
I added, "Could they be driving a new horizontal tunnel just under the surface?"
He seemed surprised.
"That's possible. I hope not. We want them to come up." He added, "Let me know if the center of the noise moves. Check on it."
"Yes, sir."
"Captain,
Huh? Speak up.
You told us not to attack when they break out. If they break out, what are we to do?
Are we just spectators?
There was a longish delay, 15 or 20 seconds, and he may have consulted upstairs. At last, he said, Mr. Rico, you are not to attack at or near Easter 10.
Anywhere else?
The idea is to hunt bugs.
Yes, sir, I agreed happily. We hunt bugs.
Johnny, he said sharply, if you go hunting metals instead of bugs, and I find out, you're going to have a mighty sad-looking Form 31.
Captain, I said earnestly, I don't ever want to win a medal. The idea is to hunt bugs.
Right. Now quit bothering me.
I called my platoon sergeant, explained the new limits under which we would work, told him to pass the word along, and to make sure that each man's suit was freshly charged, air and power.
We've just finished that, sir. I suggest that we relieve the men with you.
He named three reliefs.
That was reasonable, as my ground listeners had had no time to recharge. But the reliefs he named were all scouts. Silently, I cussed myself for utter stupidity. A scout's suit is as fast as a command suit, twice the speed of a marauder. I had been having a nagging feeling of something left undone, and had checked it off to the nervousness I always feel around bugs. Now I knew. Here I was, 10 miles away from my platoon with a party of three men, each in a marauder suit. When the bugs broke through, I was going to be faced with an impossible decision, unless the men with me could rejoin as fast as I could.
That's good, I agreed. But I no longer need three men. Send Hughes, right away. Have him relieve Nyberg. Use the other three scouts to relieve the listening posts farthest forward.
Just Hughes? He said doubtfully.
Hughes is enough. I'm going to man one listener myself. Two of us can straddle the area. We know where they are now.
I added, get Hughes down here on the bounce.
For the next 37 minutes, nothing happened. Hughes and I swung back and forth along the forward and rear arcs of the area around Easter 10, listening 5 seconds at a time, then moving on. It was no longer necessary to seat the microphone in rock. It was enough to touch it to the ground to get the sound of frying bacon, strong and clear. The noise area expanded, but its center did not change. Once I called Captain Blackstone to tell him the sound had abruptly stopped, and again 3 minutes later to tell him it had resumed. Otherwise, I used the scout's circuit and let my platoon sergeant take care of the platoon and the listening posts near the platoon. At the end of this time, everything happened at once.
A voice called out on the scout circuit, Bacon Fry, Albert 2.
I clicked over and called out, Captain, Bacon Fry at Albert 2, Black 1. Clicked over to liaison with the platoon surrounding me. Liaison flash, Bacon Frying at Albert 2, Square Black 1. And immediately heard De Campo reporting. Frying bacon sounds at Adolf 3, Green 12.
I relayed that to Blackie and cut back to my own scout circuit. Heard, Bugs, Bugs, help!
Where?
No answer. I clicked over. Sarge, who reported bugs?
He rapped back.
Coming up out of their town, about Bangkok 6.
Hit 'em.
I clicked over to Blackie.
Bugs at Bangkok 6, Black 1. I am attacking.
I heard you order it, he answered calmly.
How about Easter 10?
Easter 10 is...
The ground fell away under me, and I was engulfed in bugs.
I didn't know what had happened to me. I wasn't hurt. It was a bit like falling into the branches of a tree. But those branches were alive and kept jostling me while my gyros complained and tried to keep me upright. I fell 10 or 15 feet, deep enough to be out of daylight. Then a surge of living monsters carried me back up into the light. And training paid off. I landed on my feet, talking and fighting. Breakthrough at Easter 10,
No, Easter 11, where I am now. Big hole, and they're pouring up. Hundreds. More than that. I had a hand flamer in each hand, and was burning them down as I reported. Get out of there, Johnny. Wilco. And I started to jump. And stopped. Checked the jump in time, stopped flaming, and really looked. For I suddenly realized that I ought to be dead. Correction, I said, looking and hardly believing. Breakthrough at Easter 11 is a feint. No warriors. Repeat. Easter 11, Black 1, breakthrough is entirely by workers so far. No warriors. I am surrounded by bugs and they are still pouring out, but not a one of them is armed. And those nearest me all have typical worker features. I have not been attacked. I added, Captain, do you think this could be just a diversion, with their real breakthrough to come somewhere else? Could be, he admitted. Your report is patched through right to division, so let them do the thinking. Stir around and check what you've reported. Don't assume that they are all workers. You may find out the hard way. Right, Captain. I jumped high and wide, intending to get outside that mass of harmless but loathsome monsters. That rocky plain was covered with crawling black shapes in all directions. I overrode my jet controls and increased the jump, calling out, Hughes, report. Bugs, Mr. Rico, zillions of 'em. I'm burning 'em down. Hughes, take a close look at those bugs. Any of 'em fighting back? Aren't they all workers? I hit the ground and bounced again. He went on, Hey, you're right, sir. How did you know? Rejoin your squad, Hughes. I clicked over. Captain, several thousand bugs have exited near here, and from an undetermined number of holes. I have not been attacked. Repeat, I have not been attacked at all. If there are any warriors among them, they must be holding their fire and using workers as camouflage. He did not answer. There was an extremely brilliant flash far off to my left, followed at once by one just like it, but farther away to my right front. Automatically I noted time and bearings. Captain Blackstone, answer. At the top of my jump, I tried to pick out his beacon, but that horizon was cluttered by low hills in square black too. I clicked over and called out, Sarge, can you relay to the captain for me? At that very instant, my platoon sergeant's beacon blinked out. I headed on that bearing as fast as I could push my suit. I had not been watching my display closely. My platoon sergeant had the platoon, and I had been busy, first with grounding and listening, and most lately with a few hundred bugs. I had suppressed all but the non-comms beacons to allow me to see better. I studied the skeleton display, picked up Brumby and Kona, their squad leaders and section chasers. Kona, where's the platoon sergeant?
He's reconnoitering a hole, sir.
Tell him I'm on my way, rejoining. I shifted circuits without waiting. First platoon blackguards to second platoon, answer.
What do you want? Lieutenant Kuroshin growled.
I can't raise the captain.
You won't, he's out.
Dead?
No, but he's lost power, so he's out.
Oh, then you're company commander.
All right.
All right, so what? Do you want help?
No, sir.
Then shut up.
Kuroshin told me.
Until you do need help. We've got more than we can handle here.
Okay.
I suddenly found that I had more than I could handle. While reporting to Kuroshin, I shifted to full display and short range, as I was almost closed with my platoon. And now I saw my first section disappear one by one, Brumby's beacon disappearing first.
Kona, what's happening to the first section?
His voice sounded strained.
They are following the platoon sergeant down.
If there's anything in the book that covers this, I don't know what it is. Had Brumby acted without orders, or had he been given orders I hadn't heard? Look, the man was already down a bug hole, out of sight and hearing. Is this a time to go legal?
We would sort such things out tomorrow.
if any of us had a tomorrow.
Very well, I said. I'm back now. Report. My last jump brought me among them. I saw a bug off to my right, and I got him before I hit. No worker this. It had been firing as it moved.
I've lost 3 men, Kuna answered, gasping. I don't know what Brumby lost.
They broke out 3 places at once. That's when we took the casualties. But we're mopping them.
A tremendous shockwave slammed me just as I bounced again, slapped me sideways. 3 minutes, 37 seconds. Call it 30 miles.
Was that our sappers putting down their corks?
First section, brace yourself for another shockwave.
I landed sloppily, almost on top of a group of 3 or 4 bugs. They weren't dead, but they weren't fighting, they just twitched. I donated them a grenade and bounced again.
Hit 'em now, I called out. They're groggy, and mind that next...
The second blast hit, as I was saying it.
It wasn't as violent. Kuna, call off your section, and everybody stay on the bounce and mop up.
The call-off was ragged and slow. 2 many missing files, as I could see from my physicals display. But the mop-up was precise and fast. I ranged around the edge and got 6 bugs myself. The last of them suddenly became active just before I flamed it.
Why did concussion daze them more than it did us?
Because they were unarmored?
Or was it their brain bug somewhere down below that was dazed?
The call-off showed 19 effectives, plus 2 dead, 2 hurt, and 3 out of action through suit failure. And 2 of these, latter, Navarre was repairing by vandalizing power units from suits of dead and wounded. The 3rd suit failure was in radio and radar and could not be repaired, so Navarre assigned the man to guard the wounded, the nearest thing to pick up we could manage until we were relieved. In the meantime, I was inspecting with Sergeant Kona the 3 places where the bugs had broken through from their nest below. Comparison with the submap showed, as one could have guessed, that they had cut exits at the places where their tunnels were closest to the surface. 1 hole had closed. It was a heap of loose rock. The 2nd one did not show bug activity. I told Kona to post a lance and a private there with orders to kill single bugs. Close the hole with a bomb if they started to pour out. It's all very well for the Sky Marshal to sit up there and decide that holes must not be closed, but I had a situation, not a theory. Then I looked at the 3rd hole, the one that had swallowed up my platoon sergeant and 1/2 my platoon. Here, a bug corridor came within 20 feet of the surface, and they had simply removed the roof for about 50 feet. Where the rock went, what caused that frying bacon noise while they did it, I could not say. The rocky roof was gone and the sides of the hole were sloped and grooved. The map showed what must have happened. The other 2 holes came up from small side tunnels. This tunnel was part of their main labyrinth. So the other 2 had been diversions, and their main attack had come from here.
Can those bugs see through solid rock?
Nothing was in sight down that hole, neither bug nor human. Kona pointed out the direction the 2nd section had gone. It had been 7 minutes and 40 seconds since the platoon sergeant had gone down, slightly over 7 since Brumby had gone after him. I peered into the darkness, gulped, and swallowed my stomach. "Sergeant, take charge of your section," I said, trying to make it sound cheerful. "If you need help, call Lieutenant Koroshin."
"Orders, sir?"
"None. Unless some come down from above. I'm going down to find the 2nd section, so I may be out of touch for a while." Then I jumped down in the hole at once, because my nerve was slipping. Behind me I heard, "Section? 1st squad, 2nd squad, 3rd squad. By squads, follow me." And Kona jumped down too. It's not nearly so lonely that way. I had Kona leave 2 men at the hole to cover our rear, 1 on the floor of the tunnel, 1 at the surface level. Then I led them down the tunnel the 2nd section had followed, moving as fast as possible, which wasn't fast as the roof of the tunnel was right over our heads.
A man can move in sort of a skating motion in a powered suit without lifting his feet. But it is neither easy nor natural. We could have trotted without armor faster. Snoopers were needed at once, whereupon we confirmed something that had been theorized. Bugs see by infrared. That dark tunnel was well lighted when seen by snoopers. So far it had no special features, simply glazed rock walls arching over a smooth, level floor.
We came to a tunnel crossing, the one we were in, and I stopped short of it. There are doctrines for how you should dispose a strike force underground. But what good are they? The only certainty was that the man who had written the doctrines had never himself tried them, because, before Operation Royalty, nobody had come back up to tell what had worked and what had not. One doctrine called for guarding every intersection, such as this one. But I already used two men to guard our escape hole. If I left 10% of my force at each intersection, mighty soon I would be 10%ed to death. I decided to keep us together, and decided, too, that none of us would be captured, not by Bugs. Far better a nice, clean real estate deal. And with that decision, a load was lifted from my mind, and I was no longer worried. I peered cautiously into the intersection, looking both ways. No Bugs. So I called out over the non-comms circuit. Brumby? The result was startling. You hardly hear your own voice when using suit radio, as you are shielded from your output. But here, underground, in a network of smooth corridors, my output came back to me as if the whole complex were one enormous waveguide. Brumby. My ears rang with it, and then rang again. Mr. Rico. Not so loud, I said, trying to talk very softly to myself. Where are you? Brumby answered, not quite so deafeningly, Sir, I don't know. We're lost. Well, take it easy. We're coming to get you. You can't be far away. Is the platoon sergeant with you? No, sir. We never... Hold it. I clicked to my private circuit. Sarge? I read you, sir. His voice sounded calm, and he was holding the volume down. Brumby and I are in radio contact, but I have not been able to make rendezvous. Where are you? He hesitated slightly. Sir, my advice is to make rendezvous with Brumby's section, then return to the surface. Answer my question. Mr. Rico, you could spend a week down here and not find me, and I am not able to move. You must... Cut it, Sarge. Are you wounded? No, sir, but... Then why can't you move? Bug trouble? Lots of it. They can't reach me now, but I can't come out. So I think you had better... Sarge, you're wasting time. I am certain you know exactly what turns you took. Now tell me, while I look at the map, and give me a vernier reading on your DR tracer. That's a direct order. Report. He did so, precisely and concisely. I switched on my headlamp, flipped up the snoopers, and followed it on the map. All right, I said presently. You're almost directly under us, and two levels down. And I know what turns to take. We'll be there as soon as we pick up the second section. Hang on. I clicked over. Brumby? Here, sir. When you came to the first tunnel intersection, did you go right, left, or straight ahead? Straight ahead, sir. Okay. Kuna, bring him along. Brumby, have you got bug trouble? Not now, sir. But that's how we got lost. We tangled with a bunch of them, and when it was over, we were turned around. I started to ask about casualties, then decided that bad news could wait. I wanted to get my platoon together and get out of there. A bug town with no bugs in sight was somehow more upsetting than the bugs we had expected to encounter. Brumby coached us through the next two choices, and I tossed Tanglefoot bombs down each corridor we did not use.
Tanglefoot is a derivative of the nerve gas we had been using on the bugs in the past. Instead of killing, it gives any bug that trots through it a sort of shaky palsy. We had been equipped with it for this one operation, and I would have swapped a ton of it for a few pounds of the real stuff. Still, it might protect our flanks. In one long stretch of tunnel, I lost touch with Brumby. Some oddity and reflection of radio waves, I guess, for I picked him up at the next intersection. But there he could not tell me which way to turn. This was the place, or near the place, where the bugs had hit them. And here, the bugs hit us. I don't know where they came from. One instant, everything was quiet. Then I heard the cry of, "Bugs! Bugs!" from back of me in the column. I turned, and suddenly, bugs were everywhere. I suspect that those smooth walls are not as solid as they look. That's the only way I can account for the way they were suddenly all around us and among us. We couldn't use flamers. We couldn't use bombs. We were too likely to hit each other. But the bugs didn't have any such compunctions among themselves if they could get one of us. But we had hands, and we had feet. It couldn't have lasted more than a minute. Then there were no more bugs, just broken pieces of them on the floor. And four cap troopers down. One was Sergeant Brumby, dead. During the ruckus, the second section had rejoined. They had not been far away, sticking together to keep from getting further lost in that maze, and had heard the fight. Hearing it, they had been able to trace it by sound, where they had not been able to locate us by radio. Kuna and I made certain that our casualties were actually dead, then consolidated the two sections into one of four squads, and down we went, and found the bugs that had our platoon sergeant besieged. That fight didn't last any time at all, because he had warned me what to expect. He had captured a brain bug and was using its bloated body as a shield. He could not get out, but they could not attack him without, quite literally, committing suicide by hitting their own brain. We were under no such handicap. We hit them from behind. Then I was looking at the horrid thing he was holding, and I was feeling exultant despite our losses, when suddenly I heard close up that frying bacon noise. A big piece of roof fell on me, and Operation Royalty was over, as far as I was concerned. I woke up in a bed and thought I was back at OCS, and had just had a particularly long and complicated bug nightmare. But I was not at OCS. I was in the temporary sick bay of the Transport Orgon, and I really had had a platoon of my own for nearly 12 hours. But now I was just one more patient, suffering from nitrous oxide poisoning and overexposure to radiation through being out of armor for over an hour before being retrieved, plus broken ribs and a knock in the head which had put me out of action. It was a long time before I got everything straight about Operation Royalty, and some of it I'll never know. Why Brumby took his section underground, for example. Brumby is dead, and Naidi bought the farm next to his, and I'm simply glad that they both got their chevrons and were wearing them that day on Planet P when nothing went according to plan. I did learn eventually why my platoon sergeant decided to go down into that bug town. He had heard my report to Captain Blackstone that the major breakthrough was actually a feint, made with workers sent up to be slaughtered. When real warrior bugs broke out where he was, he had concluded, correctly, and minutes sooner than staff reached the same conclusion, that the bugs were making a desperation push, or they would not expend their workers simply to draw fire. He saw that their counterattack, made from Bugtown, was not in sufficient force, and concluded that the enemy did not have many reserves, and decided that, at this one golden moment, one man acting alone might have a chance of raiding, finding royalty, and capturing it. Remember, that was the whole purpose of the operation. We had plenty of force simply to sterilize Planet P, but our object
was to capture royalty casts and to learn how to go down in. So he tried it, snatched that one moment, and succeeded on both counts. It made it mission accomplished for the first platoon of the Blackguards. Not very many platoons out of many, many hundreds, could say that. No queens were captured. The bugs killed them first, and only 6 brains. None of the 6 were ever exchanged. They didn't live long enough. But the Psi Warfare boys did get live specimens, so I suppose Operation Royalty was a success. My platoon sergeant got a field commission. I was not offered one, and would not have accepted, but I was not surprised when I learned that he had been commissioned. Captain Blackie told me that I was getting the best sergeant in the fleet, and I had never had any doubt that Blackie's opinion was correct. I had met my platoon sergeant before. I don't think any other Blackguard knew this, not from me, and certainly not from him. I doubt if Blackie himself knew it. But I had known my platoon sergeant since my first day as a boot. His name is Zim. My part in Operation Royalty did not seem a success to me. I was in the Argonne more than a month, first as a patient, then as an undetached casual, before they got around to delivering me and a few dozen others to Sanctuary. It gave me too much time to think, mostly about casualties, and what a generally messed up job I had made out of my one short time on the ground as platoon leader. I knew I hadn't kept everything juggled the way the lieutenant used to. Why, I hadn't even managed to get wounded still swinging. I had let a chunk of rock fall on me. And casualties? I don't know how many there were. I just knew that when I closed ranks, there were only 4 squads, where I had started with 6. I didn't know how many more there might have been before Zim got them to the surface, before the Blackguards were relieved and retrieved. I didn't even know whether Captain Blackstone was still alive. He was. In fact, he was back in command about the time I went underground. I had no idea what the procedure was if a candidate was alive and his examiner was dead. But I felt that my Form 31 was sure to make me a buck sergeant again. It really didn't seem important that my math books were in another ship. Nevertheless, when I was let out of bed the first week I was in the Argonne, after loafing and brooding a day, I borrowed some books from one of the junior officers and got to work. Math is hard work and it occupies your mind, and it doesn't hurt to learn all you can of it, no matter what rank you are. Everything of any importance is founded on mathematics. When I finally checked in at OCS and turned in my pips, I learned that I was a cadet again instead of a sergeant. I guess Blackie gave me the benefit of the doubt. My roommate, Angel, was in our room with his feet on his desk, and in front of his feet was a package, my math books. He looked up and looked surprised. "Hey, Juan, we thought you had bought it." "Me? The bugs don't like me that well. When do you go out?" "Why, I've been out," Angel protested. "I left the day after you did, made 3 drops, and been back a week. What took you so long?" "Took the long way home. Spent a month as a passenger." "Some people are lucky." "What drops you make?" "Didn't make any," I admitted. He stared. "Some people have all the luck." Perhaps Angel was right. Eventually, I graduated. But he supplied some of the luck himself, in patient tutoring. I guess my luck has usually been people. Angel and Jelly, and the lieutenant and Carl, and Lieutenant Colonel Dubois. Yes, and my father. And Blackie, and Brumby, and Ace, and always Sergeant Zim. Brevet Sergeant Zim now, with permanent rank of first lieutenant.
It wouldn't have been right for me to have wound up senior to him. Benny Montiez, a classmate of mine, and I were at the fleet landing field the day after graduation, waiting to go up to our ships. We were still such brand-new second lieutenants that being saluted made us nervous, and I was covering it by reading the list of ships in orbit around Sanctuary, a list so long that it was clear that something big was stirring, even though they hadn't seen fit to mention it to me. I felt excited. I had my two dearest wishes in one package, posted to my old outfit, and while my father was still there, too. And now this, whatever it was, meant that I was about to have the polish put on me by Makey Lerney under Lieutenant Jalal, with some important drop coming. I was so full of it all that I couldn't talk about it, so I studied the lists. Phew, what a lot of ships. They were posted by types, too many to locate otherwise. I started reading off the troop carriers, the only ones that mattered to the MI. There was the Mannerheim. Any chance of seeing Carmen? Probably not. But I could send a dispatch and find out. Big ships. The new Valley Forge and the new Ypres. Marathon, El Alamein, Iwo, Gallipoli, Leyte, Marne, Tours, Gettysburg, Hastings, Alamo, Waterloo, all places where mud feet had made their names to shine. Little ships, the ones named for foot sloggers, Horatius, Alvin York, Swamp Fox, the Raj herself, bless her heart, Colonel Bowie, Devereux, Vercingetorix, Sandino, Aubrey Cousins, Kamehameha, Audie Murphy, Xenophon, Aguinaldo. I said, there ought to be one named Magasese. Benny said, what? Ramon Magasese, I explained. Great man, great soldier. Probably be chief of psychological warfare if he were alive today. Didn't you ever study any history? Well, admitted Benny, I learned that Simon Bolivar built the pyramids, licked the Armada, and made the first trip to the moon. You left out marrying Cleopatra. Oh, that, yeah. Well, I guess every country has its own version of history. I'm sure of it. I added something to myself, and Benny said, what did you say? Sorry, Bernardo. Just an old saying in my own language. I suppose you could translate it more or less as, home is where the heart is. But what language was it? Tagalog, my native language. Don't they talk standard English where you come from? Oh, certainly, for business and school and so forth. We just talk the old speech around home a little. Traditions, you know. Yeah, I know. My folks chatter in Espanol the same way. But where do you... The speaker started playing Meadowland. Bernie broke into a grin. Got a date with the ship. Watch yourself, fella. See ya. Mind the bugs. I turned back and went on reading the ship's names. Palma later, Montgomery, Chaka, Geronimo. Then came the sweetest sound in the world. Shines the name of Roger Young. I grabbed my kit and hurried. Home is where the heart is. I was going home.